Good morning. My name is Tom Kramer. I'm the Associate Director for Digital Library Systems and Services at Stanford University. And my English will increase in speed the faster and the more I go through the presentation. So if that becomes an issue, friends in the audience, raise your hand and go like this. Joseph, I'm looking at you. Very good. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to come today and speak about some of the lessons that we have learned at Stanford University over the last decade as we've been working on building out a digital library for the university. The theme of today's talk is not only some of the lessons we've learned, but having to adapt to different circumstances and take the best of many different pieces and many different animals, which I think is a good analogy to a chimera, the mythical beast, which was a combination of goat, lion, and serpent. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about Stanford University. I'm going to talk about Stanford University Libraries and Academic Information Resources, which is SULAIR. One working definition of a digital library that we found instructive and useful as we've been conducting our development programs, six concrete lessons that we've learned in the course of the last few years, and also some final thoughts on moving forward with digital libraries on the whole. So one of the things I learned when I was traveling in the United Kingdom late last year is that Stanford University is often translated to the University of Stanford. And in fact, there is no such place. Stanford University is in fact named after Leland Stanford Jr., who Leland Stanford was the elder gentleman here. He was a railroad magnate, built many of the trains, and in fact, the Transcontinental Railroad across the United States. He was the one who drove the Golden Spike, the mythical Golden Spike, between as they were building the railroads from the West Coast and the East Coast. They met in the middle, and they cemented that. Well, he sucked millions of dollars out of that project and became one of the truly rich California millionaires associated with the gold rush. And when he and his wife Jane's only son died at the age of 15 when he was in Italy touring from tuberculosis, they decided to leave their rather large fortune and their horse ranch in Palo Alto to the children of California and to create a university for the future of the children of the state. And at this point, Stanford University is 15,000 students. It has about 2,000 faculty and a total university community of 35,000 members, faculty, staff, students, associated scholars. There's a $3.4 billion annual operating budget with about a $20 billion endowment, though that's probably much closer to about 10, given the events of the last few months. It's also the roots of Silicon Valley. Hewlett and Packard was born. They were both electrical engineering students at the university. And I believe it was in the 30s and 40s they spun out and had the first Silicon Valley startup. And today Stanford is widely recognized as one of the world's leading research universities. The libraries for the university have about 8.5 million or 9 million volumes. We subscribe to 75,000 current serials. We have hundreds of thousands of cartographic resources, about 60 million manuscript pages. We acquire from 120 countries in 400 different languages. 110,000 volumes are acquired each year. And until the real estate boom associated with the dot-com boom in the 1990s, the library's collections was actually the number one item on the list of assets for the university. Above the land, above the buildings, above all of the patents, above anything else that the university had. So as we work at Stanford in terms of trying to identify what we're developing, we think of an online digital library as the same thing as a library with four important differentiators. First is that there is a substantial number of online collections. There's a lot of digital stuff. Second, similar to a library where you have a reading room, you have to have tools, services, and environments where patrons can make use of the digital content that you're generating and that you're storing. Third is you have to have a back office infrastructure. Thank you. Third is you have to have a back office infrastructure in order to be able to support the services and the content that sit on top. And fourth, you need a set of information professionals who can make the entire enterprise run. How are we doing on speed? English? All of your English is really good? Okay, good. So looking at this pictorially, what we have is a set of content, a set of services and a set of infrastructure. And the content by itself is actually, you can't touch it and you can't use it until it's been wrapped in a set of services for providing access to the information resources, to be able to discover them, to be able to deliver them through tailor-made interfaces, and also to be able to use them in things like collaboration systems, publication systems, to be able to mark them up and to be able to share them. As any of you who have built small systems know, you also, in the U.S., the term is stovepipe, which is a straight up and down system which doesn't integrate with other pieces. And if you want to get out of building a lot of stovepipe systems and a lot of one-off systems that don't scale and are difficult to support, you have to have a large underlying infrastructure. And for us, we classify our digital preservation system, our repository, as part of that infrastructure, as well as a set of content management and content middleware services, things that address security or digital rights management, and of course, a data center, the data center infrastructure for the storage, the servers, the databases, the network. So what are some of the things that we've learned in the course of a decade or so at Stanford? And the first thing is that a digital library is like a three-legged stool. Unless you have all three legs, it can't stand on its own. And by that, with the first experience that we had in this is digitization. Any of you who've done digitization have probably learned by now, it's really easy to digitize something. You can take a picture, you can stream it into a computer, and you can get a digital surrogate for that work. The hard thing is coming up with all the stuff that happens after digitization. So you have to attach that to its metadata. You have to have a workflow system that routes it through several sequential steps. It has to end up in a preservation system. It has to end up in your online catalog, and it has to end up being deliverable through some means. And what we found in our early experiences with digitization is the worst thing you can do is digitize something and not have those other pieces lined up, because then you've suddenly got gigabytes or terabytes of files, which you can't manage. You have metadata associated with those objects strewn across various different systems, and you have someone who asked you to digitize it wondering where their stuff is, because in fact they didn't want it digitized, they wanted access to it. So one of the things that we are doing is working out on building broad capabilities for digitizing all different types of content. So books, images, manuscripts, audio, video, and now we're even starting up to be able to preserve software. So software that came in the 70s, 80s, or early 90s, which are on these historical disk drives and other types of handheld media, we're beginning to see that decay in our collections, in our special collections, and we want to recover those items and actually make them available. We envision providing things like software libraries going into the future. So that's what I mean when I'm talking about a demonstrated need for a holistic approach, is that we actually need to be able to support all the various facets of digital content. Another way to look at content services and infrastructure is in a schematic view. So up here we have digitized materials, purchased and licensed content, things that are digitized by Google, whom we're working with. They're digitizing the entire holdings of Stanford's collections. All of these things come into something, some kind of cloud. It's not external cloud computing, it's internal cloud computing. And they sit on top of a set of infrastructure for managing that content and tracking that content, very similar to what an integrated library system or library management system does for traditional materials. It makes use of our back office preservation infrastructure, which we call the Stanford Digital Repository, and it sits on top of a hardware infrastructure. On the top, we have a series of services that actually let people make use of that material. So can you actually find it? Can you actually get it? If it's in an image, can you zoom, pan, and rotate? Those kinds of services. Since we're also a university, we're seeking to tightly couple the outputs of our digital library with our course management system, which is also called Sakai, so students and teachers can make use of the materials inside the context of a course. So what we've been working on and what we're pursuing right now are five co-equal strategies. These are all important priorities. So the first one is digitization, and we continue to do digitization at a rapid pace and continue to make use of or make plans and build capacity to make use of the digitized artifacts from other people, primarily Google. We're also focused on managing the digital resources, whether digitized or born digital, as as a core capability. So something that's more intelligent and more powerful than just putting these on a set of file systems and having a good system administrator or content administrator that remembers where they are. If you don't have a digital preservation system, in the long term, you know that you're going to end up having to re-digitize all these materials. And so that's an overriding priority for us. Finally, we're focused also both on the discovery and the delivery of these items. So building on that first lesson, which is you need a holistic approach, is the fact that a digital library is not itself a system, and even at a very small scale, you need to have more of an ecosystem approach or an ecosystem mindset. So rather than looking for a single solution or a single silver bullet, what we're looking for is a series of systems and a series of solutions that work with each other, interoperate with each other, and provide the complete functions of a digital library. So, put another way, looking at the digital library environment, we have all sorts of different repositories of content. We have our digital repository for preservation. We have our digitized materials that exist on our collections websites. We have digitized texts that are coming from vendors. We have image databases. We have locks caches, which is another peer-to-peer network preservation system. We have a course management system, and we even have what we call EAMS, which are published web documents, born digital materials that we're bringing into the library. Trying to network all of those things and trying to manage all of those things as a coherent whole is hard enough. We also have digitization, the outputs of digitization workflows, both internal and from Google. We have a series of information management systems at the top. So our integrated library system, SFX, or an electronic resource management system to manage licensed materials. All of those need to work with things like our OPAC, with our full text indices, with media players, geospatial apps, image servers, and with things that allow for services like text mining, data mining, analytic tools, markup tools. There's a growing set of external infrastructure outside of the library itself that support things like format registries, authentication, authorization, and rights management. And that's just all within the context of the university. When you start adding in external stores that might be available through federated content providers, it becomes a very complex picture. And the question is, how do you knit all of those things together? One of the things that we know won't work from experience and from working with our ILS and our ILS vendor is that the hardware approach, which is the sense of you try to hammer it all into your ILS, is not going to work. Our integrated library system was never built to be able to accomplish all of these functions for these digital materials. And we know that trying to make the ILS the centerpiece of this new environment is a strategy that's doomed to fail. This might be an Americanism, but does anyone remember the show MacGyver from the 80s? So MacGyver was a very clever fellow, and he could get out of any sticky patch by inventing something with chewing gum and duct tape and paper clips and then making a rocket launcher or a hang glider. And that's essentially the other approach, which is let's not have any central system or any cohesive approach, and instead we'll write a series of scripts which knits all of these things together. We'll do dozens or maybe hundreds of point-to-point integrations. And at the end, basically you have a MacGyver solution, which is one of these paper clips could fly off at any given time, and it will cascade through your entire environment, and you'll be in a mess of trouble. That also didn't seem very appealing to us. Instead, what we're looking on is a set of what we call content middleware, content in library services middleware, which has a couple of different functions to it. So it's a content registry, not a repository, but a registry, which tracks and understands where content is across the entire library. It understands what access and what security is associated with each one of those, and it's working with these external systems to actually broker access to those systems. It also has some notion of collections, not just content, but how are people grouping those pieces together in order to provide coherent collections or sets of services that make sense to patrons in a university environment. Combined with access brokering services and reporting, intelligence, monitoring, policy-based systems, you begin to look at something that looks a little bit more coherent. And this is, in fact, how we're beginning to think of our environment. It's not a service-oriented architecture in a technical or narrow sense, but, in fact, looks at both the integrated library system And a parallel to it, the digital object registry, in our terms, to keep track of digital content and traditional content, combined with systems that work on deposit, capture, subscription, and management of those materials, with supporting middleware for monitoring, workflow, and reporting, a preservation infrastructure, and the ability to serve that up into a variety of tailored discovery environments, delivery environments, and portals and delivery platforms. And the notion is that you can mix and match these services and these components in any way to meet your various needs for different types of content and different types of use contexts. So the third lesson is, if you can't find it, you can't use it. And at Stanford, there are, I showed you earlier, 15,000 students and 2,000 faculty who all regard themselves as the preeminent experts in themselves and in their field. And they have very high standards of expectations, and they really want to be able to find the systems that they have and the information resources that they need, and if they can't find it, they'll let you know about it. Unfortunately, our library system, OPAC, is great in the sense that it has almost 6 million items in it. It's rather poor in the fact that it doesn't have any relevance ranking in it. It has an interface that looks more like it came out of the 80s, not even the 90s, in terms of being usable and being able to find things. And it doesn't even have all of our content in it. Because, in fact, while we do have, in fact, almost 6 million individual records in our library management system and our OPAC, we have hundreds of thousands of things, individual things that don't show up in the OPAC. We subscribe to about 25,000 different e-journals, none of which are reflected in our online public access category. In addition to 800 licensed databases, we have 20 different physical libraries, and we have a Department of Special Collections, which is largely unprocessed and uncataloged materials sitting in archival boxes and holdings. So, in fact, trying to come up with a discovery system is the main challenge, because the problem is not search. Because if you know what you're looking for, then you know where to find it. And if we're looking for known item retrieval, that's really not the issue. What Stanford faculty and Stanford students are asking for is discovery, which is specifically, they're looking for a powerful system that does relevance ranking for search terms across heterogeneous information sources, along with the ability to browse. They're very concerned with the ability to actually be able to find things serendipitously. So that is, they find something that's similar to what they're looking for, and they want to look on the shelf to the left and to the right of that item and see where their path leads them and what they didn't know was out there but will be useful to them. For the humanists and the social sciences in particular, they're also interested about browsing within a work. So they want to, once they identify a potential resource, especially an online one, they want to be able to look at it before they go to the library and get it, or is increasingly is the case, page it from off-campus services or off-campus holding facilities. Now, at Stanford, we're finally beginning to see a more elaborate and more sophisticated approach to discovery, which is, I think, finally catching up to what the internet and the World Wide Web have been providing to people for information resources on the web itself. So in this case, combining our finding aids from special collections, images, media, electronic theses and dissertations, together with our OPAC records, full text materials, and even materials from externally held licensed databases, is what we're beginning to do. And there's a recurring pattern coming up with taking the indexing and the records from all of these things and munging them together into one massive Lucene and Solr index and providing discovery services on top of that. And this is an example of a system of this nature at Stanford, which we call SearchWorks, in parallel to Socrates, which is our online public access catalog. And if you do a search in SearchWorks on, say, Slovakia, you can immediately limit it using facets, very common from e-commerce sites or sites like Amazon, to access being online, language in Slovakia, and within 3 clicks and about 12 keystrokes, I find that there are 19 holdings within the Stanford University libraries on Slovakia that are relevance ranked, and even for images or for materials that have been digitized, there is a thumbnail image of what it looks like. This is fantastic stuff. Our students and our faculty love it, and our librarians love it, and they hate it because it's a very different model. It's a little bit different than what they've thought about, And they really like the paradigm of an advanced search field where you can fit in 15 or 16 search arguments across all of the MARC field and get exactly what you want, not realizing that librarians are really the only people who, and senior faculty are the only people who search that way because they've learned how to do it. The other thing that you can begin to build in through these kind of Chimera-like applications is the ability to do things like support serendipity. So here on the right, we're actually suggesting similar items, either powered by call number or powered by full textual analysis and vector analysis of the full text of the materials. And say, based on this record, we have similar items that match what you're looking for. And in this case, the results are actually pretty good. The other thing, and I don't know if you've seen this from Google Books, is they're actually supporting an API where you can embed their book reader for content that they've scanned inside your systems. And so to support the browsing within Works, we've actually embedded this within our new catalog, and you can not only see the cover of the image, but you can flip through and you can read this entire book online, and they've hyperlinked things like the table of contents and the index. So if you find something on the financial sector of Slovakia that you want to read, you can actually click on this link and jump to that section of the page immediately. It's an extremely powerful tool. So lesson number four is that looks matter, or appearance matters, and libraries need the equivalent of the digital stacks. And in a traditional world, if you want something off of the shelf in the U.S., at least where we have OpenStax, you walk down the aisles, you go to the shelf that you want, you pull it off, and you have immediate access to the materials. We need to be able to support the same level of access to our materials. And so what we're looking at is trying to develop a suite of powerful and rich information applications that allow for things like image viewing, media streaming, manuscript viewing, book viewing, and even data delivery for geospatial information or for data itself. In the future, all of that has to work with the ability to do annotations, analytics, and the ability to collaborate or publish on materials. Is there any water in the room? Getting more and more dry, but we'll keep going. One example that we have is the Parker Manuscript Library. There are 538 Anglo-Saxon manuscripts in Corpus Christi College in Cambridge University, which have since the 16th century been sitting untouched and largely unread within the Cambridge University libraries. These were granted by the Archbishop of Canterbury to the college, which was his alma mater, in order to endow the university library under the condition that no more than three of them ever be lost. And so the university or the college librarians at Corpus Christi have been very conservative about lending them out, and effectively they've been chained in a small room locked away from most of the world's scholars for four or five centuries. In partnership with Cambridge University, Stanford has been digitizing all of these images, putting them online so accessible and accessible to everyone in the world, and with a rich set of bibliographic services. So you can do full text search, you can search the catalog, and you can navigate and browse across the entire collection. So this is a page that formerly you would have to have been one of literally a handful of scholars to be able to get access to the Parker Library, is now available to anyone in the world. And not only can you read it, but you can read it at incredibly fine detail from anywhere in the world, which is, I think, one of the examples of the power of digital library systems for making resources that were otherwise inaccessible accessible to the world. And we also have a series of applications around searching for and delivering images, being able to deliver media, either audio or video, in the context of a collection, whether textual resources or other. The ability I showed you earlier, the Google Books book reader, the ability to actually see full text, search full text, and skip to full text. Excuse me. And we're beginning to see the development of data libraries and data resources where you can take things like social science data and search through it, extract tables that are of interest, and present that to patrons. So in this case, these are social science data sets from the United States dealing things like the US Census. Finally, we're looking at the development of new systems like delivery of library materials through new platforms like Second Life. Now, in this case, it's rather silly to make a book 20 feet tall in virtual reality in order to read something that you can hold in your hands in real life. But what I think we're seeing is the ability for avatars, for patrons, to get together and be able to collaboratively work on these digital resources. And while for textual materials, it's rather hokey, for audio and video and image materials, we're beginning to see that this is, in fact, a very promising way to deliver resources, and not only resources in a flat or two-dimensional web, but resources where we can have simultaneous events both in real life and in Second Life, and have joint... If there is any water... I feel awkward walking upstairs to get some. Thank you very much. We're beginning to see that these are powerful tools for having joint sessions, collaborations, symposia, both in real life and in Second Life at the same time. Okay, so lesson number 5, preservation doesn't come easy. And preservation is not a one-time event. Over the last 4 years, we have been building in earnest a preservation system that is designed to act as a back office preservation infrastructure for all the different content of the university, not only for the libraries, but for the institution on the whole. And we intend, and in fact have, specialized digital library applications that sit on top and basically use this from their perspective as a disaster recovery and business continuity system. And from the Stanford Digital Repository's perspective, they're providing long-term preservation and a long-term option to get to these materials. And the preservation repository doesn't have to worry about direct access or delivery of the materials that it's holding, which we think is perhaps not so clever as having a combined system, but is in fact the best way to structure the separation of concerns between access to materials and preservation of them. So right now, the Stanford Digital Repository has about 30... You're suffering with me. Thank you. You have to listen to me and I have to talk. Has about 30, 35 terabytes of unique material with about 100 terabytes of managed storage. We have 4 different types of content coming in, content streams, so being geospatial data, being images, being textual objects, that kind of generic content, spanning 14 different collections. Even though it's a back office archive, we are providing, we have a relatively small number of access events, but which thankfully have all been successfully granted. Oh, that looks good. For the next speaker, since I'm almost done. Thank you very much. Excuse me. So the software's been through 7 major releases, and we've done hardware migrations and storage migrations almost 4 times at this point. And all of this is the result of approximately 4 years of work with a team of about 6 people with lots of custom code. This is not to say that we're doing anything well or that we're doing anything poorly, but it's to say that preservation is relatively hard. This is a relatively big team. Many of our peer institutions look at the size of our investment and our effort with envious eyes, and yet compared to what we have to ingest and what we have to preserve, this is just a drop in the bucket. And at this point, what we're looking for is to rewrite and extend major portions of the repository. Refactor the existing code that we have, add or significantly enhance modules which exist in very shallow terms right now, especially the administration and the access to the materials. We're working on adopting Fedora as a metadata management layer, layer, and we have to dramatically simplify and standardize the data model. What we're finding is our librarian tendencies got in the way of doing something that was scalable and easy, and we were overly prescriptive on the data as it's coming in. And I see several of you smiling because you made the same mistake, or you had people who you work with who wanted to make that mistake and you successfully argued them out of it. I'm getting faster. Finally, the last thing that we have to do is increase throughput of the existing system, especially of the storage subsystem. We have, as I said, about 30, 35 terabytes of content right now. We have about 300 to 350 terabytes that we need to take in immediately, and that will grow to half a petabyte, and then a petabyte within 1 year and then 2 years, respectively. So lesson number six is be good to your IT provider. Digital libraries aren't just libraries, but they're also IT shops. And at Stanford, this is the growth in servers and the growth in disk over the last 4 years. And 4 years ago, believe it or not, we had about 15 servers and 35 terabytes of disk, and we thought we were something special. And at this point, the physical number of servers in our environment is actually beginning to taper off. And if you counted virtual machines, though, this number in the last year would be up here. It would be about 220. And that I'm really looking forward to, as this provides us all sorts of abilities to come up with new applications without increasing the physical footprint in the data center. Disk, however, shows no signs of slowing. And in fact, I think we'll continue at this pace for the foreseeable future. So in terms of final thoughts, in terms of lessons, everything that we've seen up to this point is just a drop in the bucket. It's nothing compared to what we're going to see. In particular, everything that we're developing on both the front end and the back end, it will all be gone and will all be comic in the within a decade, the way we look back at the World Wide Web from 10 years ago and think, well, isn't that quaint? That requires a bold mindset that requires the ability to think, not only am I developing systems today, but I know I'm developing systems that I myself am probably going to have to replace. And at Stanford, we call that building tomorrow's legacy code today. Second is, compared to all the digitized materials that we have, which is a substantial amount of work, and we are talking about digitizing 5 or 6 million different records or different volumes within the Stanford libraries, which Google is doing, that seems like a lot of work. In fact, compared to the video that's coming and to the born digital data sets that are coming, it's nothing. And that is going to look like child's play and actually is beginning to look like child's play. Even when you compare video, which is one collection, relatively small collection of video that we are working on right now, is 45 terabytes. We anticipate that all the Google books that are being scanned right now and are taking an incredible amount of labor will be about 450 terabytes. So we're talking about one collection is one-tenth of all of our print holdings. And then finally, there's a saying from the American Revolution, which is in the United States, after the Revolutionary Forefathers basically decided to secede from America, one of them said, well, if we don't hang together, we will surely hang apart. Which is that they would all be separately tracked down and punished by the United Kingdom or by the King of Britain. And I think in terms of the library as a community, it's especially important that we don't, as in some cases you feel like you have to, as we did 4 years ago with our digital preservation repository, go out and develop your own code because you don't see something there. But instead, it's critical to hang together as a community, whether that's through vendors or through open source development, and come up with common solutions and common platforms, because we can't afford to do it by ourselves. And another griffin. This is a griffin. It's half eagle and half lion, and is supposed to be the king of the birds and the king of the beasts, and I think is a fitting guardian and a fitting metaphor for what the library could provide, both the best of the traditional world and the best of the digital world. And that's it. Thank you very much.